Welcome to the 53rd episode of the Jewish Drinking Show. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan, and I'm very excited about this episode.
Because we have almost Rabbi Joshua Schwartz. He's already Joshua Schwartz. He's just almost a rabbi. And he currently serves as the spiritual leader for Beth Lita Forest Hill Synagogue in Toronto. And amongst his illustrious activities, he's the co-creator of the world's first art venture, Seder Oneg Shabbos, the editor of the first ever Talmud graphic novel, The Illustrated Pirkei Avot, and also the translator for the anthology of Torah and Music, the Torah of Music. So thank you so much, Almost Rabbi Joshua Schwartz, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Drew. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So let's start off with the very first question, which is, what are you drinking?
That's a great question. So I want to give praise to my best friend, Kenny, who got me a wonderful bottle of Kilcommon Scotch. And just so no one says I am any kind of hypocrite, although it ends up getting more, we're going to get more complicated and complex about it and nuanced anyway, it's not sherry casked. So don't yell at me in the comments. No trolls, no haters. All right. So
nice. I like the style. It's a nice little Isla.
Yeah. Oh, I love peat. I love the smoke, baby.
Yeah. I love the peat and the smoke. I'm going for something quite simple. It's Glenfiddich 12. Nice, simple. It's like a nice little standard.
As long as it's not that trash Glenlivet. Yeah, come at me, haters. Come at me. All right.
I think Glenlivet 12 is a nice little introductory scotch.
Oh, you're such a good rabbi.
And then you graduate. And then you know.
You know what's, yeah. All right. Yeah. I'd rather have doers, honestly.
Than Glenlivet 12, yeah.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, well, L'chaim. Right.
L'chaim, L'chaim. Shakol Negevi, right. Umayim.
We have this really fascinating topic, which is not simply academic, but really, it is a practical matter, which is talking about beer as well as whiskey being aged or otherwise stored in wine containers that had previously held Gentile wine, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is something you're going to run into. It's like a fun domestic halachic issue because there's nothing that Orthodox Jews love more than scotch. And,
or beer. You know, it's, beer's, you know, a small but growing.
All right, yeah, listen, I'm a brewer myself. You're not going to brook any argument from me.
We have this Talmudic text right here, this Avodah Zarah 33b. Where we have, this is the entire conversation in the entirety of the Babylonian Talmud, which is, there's this question that appears in a sugya, in a pericope, in a discussion that talks about jugs that were used for Gentile wine, these kankanim, shel ovdei kochavim, right, these jugs. So it was asked of these Amoraim, these third and fourth century rabbis in Babylonian, in Sasanian Persia, what about putting beer in them? So wine has its problems, but what about putting beer in them? So we have these third century rabbis who say, this is a problem. Rav Nachman and Rav Yehuda say, no go, this is a problem. But then we have potentially the greatest rabbi of the entire Babylonian Talmud, Rava, who comes along and says, no, this is fine. This is totally cool. Like, that's fine. And then subsequently, we have, and he's in the fourth century, and then we have Ravina, who comes a little after him, and he permits for a particular person, Rav Chia Barei Derav, and Derav Yitzchak, who says, yeah, you can pour beer into it. It's fine. And he even screwed up. This guy he permitted to pour beer into there and poured wine in there, even that he was okay with. So we have ultimately, and this is the way that the sort of halacha works, is that the later rabbis, even though these first two rabbis, Rav Nachman and Rav Yehuda, say this is a problem, you should not be storing beer in jugs and kankanim, and I don't know how else to translate jar, kankanim. How would you translate kankanim?
Yeah, jugs, casks.
Yeah. Things, yeah, so they clearly...
But importantly, something porous, right? Because the issue is that it's going to be something probably made of earthenware. So the point, though, is that it's absorptive and it's going to be also emitting whatever it was absorbing. So that's the fear.
Right. And there are also things that people are fairly portable, right? They're carrying them around. And so they're small enough. And even though these two earlier rabbis say it's a problem, the two later rabbis say it's fine. So, thoughts?
There's not really anything to say because all they just give is their positions.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, is there's zero reasoning given. There's no reasoning provided. It's just simply,
right,
you know, hey, look, we have no idea for any of these four rabbis, and they all might be operating off of different reasons altogether.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, you know, what it takes is for it to get, like, taken up into the halachic discourse, right? For it then to factor in the other issues when it has to do with Gentile wine and issues about having to do with nicing tam lifgam, right? Something that adds some kind of depreciating or ruining taste to something.
Right.
Or then issues, you know, like ex post facto issues, like non-kosher material getting nullified because it's outweighed or overwhelmed by the kosher material.
Right. So I think you're right on the right, you know, the right path, which is that it's a taste-related issue. And that's something that we start to see
as... Well, as they say, right, Tom Kicker, right? Like, this is... It's kind of a taste issue in the sense that, like, it might also be something... Because let's say there's a substance that's seen as so very dangerous. Like, it's such an inherently dangerous substance that is considered, like, its own thing that is challenging and problematic and scary and can't be incorporated or touched in any way, shape, or form. Right, something like a, you know, like what's called in halacha, right? A piece that's become like itself inherently uncool. So that one, it's not going to be able to. That's not about taste. That's just about contact, right? That's about presence. Mm-hmm. So that's less empirical. It's more, I guess you'd say, it's formal. It's categorical.
Yeah. So we don't know, right? So we don't know. We do have getting into some medieval ideas. Rashi comes along, the great, pithy commentator of the Talmud, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, and he says here, we've got in the sources, that basically the shichra mevatale l'taima d'chamra, that the beer gets rid of the flavor of the wine. Basically, I almost want to say vanquishes, like it overpowers and it just sort of gets rid of the wine flavor. Like, it's not significant compared to the power of the beer flavor. Right? Is that a fair description of Rashi's take on the reasoning of, at least the reasoning of Ravina in this instance?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's bottle.
Right. Right. But the mechanic of the bitul, of the sort of the pushing aside, is because it's overpowering. Right, it's not because it's a bad flavor. It's that the flavoring is overpowering of the beer over the wine.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the general logic behind a bittel.
Okay, I also threw on this little source sheet, which I'm going to make available for people on the show notes. That we have also Tosfos here, which is that it also works for other beverages as long as it's not wine. Because if you work off the mechanics that it has to overpower the flavor of the wine, you can't use wine to overpower wine because it's just going to be all wine. Although the fascinating and amusing thing here in Tosfos is that it even includes water. And that's a little shocking because water has no inherent flavor, right? It could be
right.
But it's not a flavor that's going to overpower wine. We have this source here from the 14th century of the Tour, and he says the reason is that the reason that this mechanic works is actually different than Rashi has suggested, is because that the wine screws up the beer.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, so when there's some kind of food that's like left over in something, like over 24 hours especially, the food is said to have spoiled or gone stale, and whatever it's adding into the substance is going to be not going to add anything positive to it. It's just going to make it ruined or depreciated in some way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So this is a very different mechanic, that the wine is screwing up the more voluminous beverage being installed.
Yes, it would. That's a nice contrast, right? So Rashi is saying that the beer would be, the non-wine would be outweighing the wine, and here the wine is not going away, but the fact that it's adding something actually is an escape clause for us.
Well,
like,
that's
our safety hatch.
Well, Tour here is saying that the wine is screwing up the beer.
Right. I was saying it doesn't get bottled, right? It doesn't get nullified, but that's good for us, right? In the sense that it ruining it it not being nullified ends up being good for us halachically, because that means that we can permit it.
Maybe, depending upon which way
you... No, I'm thinking inside of the tour, right? I'm thinking
okay, inside, I mean, ultimately, it actually would say it would be a problem for Scott, for anybody who loves enjoying their beer or whiskey in wine barrels. This is a problem, because this is wrong, because we know that it doesn't make this beer or whiskey worse. It actually enhances it.
Well, right. Well, this is why I'm especially interested in this topic, is that I think there's a lot of interesting things happening, like not on top of the halacha, but are happening like alongside or even inside the halacha, right? That like this is a really interesting like meta halachic question, because it involves two, for my like looking at it, it involves two really interesting issues. One is basically a market issue, namely, if people want it enough, is it enough to justify using every like loophole you can figure out so that like, oh, phew, the Yidden can have good scotch at their chasanas, right? That like we can have good whiskey at our weddings or parties or kiddish clubs or whatever, right? Like we shouldn't be deprived of such things, because whiskey has become, I mean, interestingly, I think it's also an interesting question about like contemporary American orthodoxy and like masculinity, right? How like central booze and meat is to like, and kind of a certain kind of like American macho-ness to what it means to be like an Orthodox Jew in today's world. So like there's enough of like a market demand for it that actually we're gonna like force the halacha to go where we want it to go. Or the second issue is also really interesting, but a little bit more subtle, is in thinking about this question, are you going to relate to it as like a set of categories, or are you gonna relate to it as a set of experiences with meaning? And what I mean is, when you look at the issue about the wine being like emitted back into the scotch, the tour says very flatly, or into the beer, the tour says that when that happens, it's nice and time we've got. You're adding a negative flavor to it, and because of that, it's not a halachic problem anymore. But you kind of countered and said, wait a second, but if you think about it empirically, or as I said earlier, right, distilleries brag about having sherry cask whiskey, right? It's clearly seen as a value add. So if that's the case, then it seems like from that kind of more experiential perspective or a realist perspective, then you can't say it's no St. Tom Leaf gum, even though the tour would say it sure seems like it, right? So that's like, that's what's so interesting about this question, is that like, are you going to, is it going to be like halacha playing by its own rules? Or are you going to see halacha as working inside of a world in which it is talking to the world and the world is talking back to it, right? Helping us try to understand what halacha is trying to do. In which case you might not be able to find so many room for kulas. Who knows? We'll see. We're going on a journey. It's a journey. Well, the another issue which is interesting too is also the question of the substances we're talking about. So with beer, it might be a different calculus than if we're talking about whiskey, because beer is a more mellow substance, less alcoholic, whereas scotch is sharper, and it might be kind of related to more like something like wine, or something that is more like penetrating because of its strength. That's another variable taken into consideration.
An intriguing avenue. I have the standard, the Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Karo's 15th century, and it's he says it's fine. Again, just like the Talmud, though, no reason is offered, right? It's fine.
Right.
Just as long as he says, "Vilvad she'adich b'tchila lachluch lehayayin she'alpnei ha'kelim." You got to get rid of the like the wine residue that's still hanging out, the like the wetness. But as long as you rinse that off. Great. He's not worried about anything that could be hanging out inside of whatever the container is, whatever it's made of, just as long as you don't just have wine splashing around in there.
Well, yeah, so I'm not sure about that per se, because here we have, I think you're raising a really good point, that are we talking about the substance of the wine, right? And the Shulchan Aruch says we cannot deal with substance of the wine. If there's wine in it, you got to rub it down, wipe it out. You can't have wine in it. But when we're talking about something that's absorbed, right, that's, you know, as we know, it's what's called blios. Right, so if we're talking about blios, then that has a different, we relate to that, because that's actually, it's related to in a different kind of way than like the actual gufa, right, the actual substance of the wine itself. This is like wine, like one level abstracted from it. It's like the notion of wine, in a sense. Can the notion of wine be returned back into what's going on?
I want to get right next to the Taz, I'm sorry, the Shach, who says, and he uses Rashi's reasoning, Mit mishum vatlin tam hayayin. that because it that the beer's flavor overpowers the wine flavor.
Right.
So,
But the Taz actually does bring back the tour.
Right.
The Taz actually brings right. back the Pegima issue, and the Bach does as well.
Right. Which I conveniently omitted, but I should definitely include in those sources.
Well, yeah, I've got my own Safari page up on my own computer.
That's good.
That's
So in my read, what I like about it so far, in my, you know, my narrative, as it were, is that the understanding that the reason why maybe, let's say, Rav Nachman or Rav Yehuda, maybe they thought you can't really get rid of that wine flavor. It's still, to some degree, going to be in that container. But Rava and Ravina were saying, like, it's you can have some wine flavor. That's fine. It's not that significant of a wine flavor that's really going to make that much of a difference. And ultimately, Rashi and Shach agree with that. They say, Rashi and Shach ultimately agree and say, look, the overwhelming overpowering of the flavor of beer of wine over the wine that's still, you know, the residue is still left in there, you know, that's going to work. That's a mechanic that they're fine with, right?
Right, yeah.
That's what I like. I'm not such a fan of the tour for the exact reason I mentioned before.
Oh, that's interesting.
It doesn't reflect reality.
Well, yeah, here's an interesting question, right? Is that so? In a sense, yeah. So I want to give a shabach to the authors of Akiva Niehaus, Rabbi Akiva Niehaus of Chicago Rabbinical Council, the great CRC, wrote a very knowledgeable, very well researched kuntres on cherry casks in halacha, which I had a lot of fun learning through, and he takes it like in a step by step thing, and he actually goes through the exact same I think kind of process that you went through, Drew, because he brings up both of those issues precisely, namely one. Do we need to care about the flavor, or is the fact that it's going to be nice and tom leaf gum, it's going to be ruining the flavor, is that like an escape hatch for us? It gets us out of this problem. And he goes through it and says, and what's interesting is, he doesn't say this, but from my like learning material, what's really fascinating is that like you see the categories, again, bump up against the reality, right? Because categorically speaking, it sure seems like it would be, because according to the words in the Shulchan Aruch, anything that's not wine, that you can keep it in a non-wine thing. You can, it says you can. So like, why can't you? And the answer is because like, if you just pay attention to the reality of the substance and the fact, the way it's marketed, the way it's appreciated, it's clear that it's missing tam leshevach. And like, if you're gonna take, and I think that's a really interesting and important like halachic point, that like, we need to commit to the reality of Torah. The Torah is not just giving us categories and concepts. Torah is trying to guide us through life. We can't just say like, oh, listen, the Torah says the thing. And even though like in my mind, I know it's false, I'm just going to like listen to it. You have to like, so I think it's actually trying to argue for some kind of integration versus a certain kind of like schizophrenia that I think we kind of see often in modern Orthodox life, in which it's like, okay, shul life is one thing, regular life is another thing, and never the twain shall meet.
Or differently formulated, reality and halachic reality.
Right, exactly. Right?
It works for the books in halacha, but that's not really reflective of what we actually experience in the world.
Exactly, right. There's some kind of like mystical reality out there that Shulchan Aruch is talking about, even though I've never tasted it. But man, that sherry cask whiskey sure tastes good.
Yeah.
Right, but then once it's noitzein tam leshevach, right, once we're clear that it's improving the taste of the wine, then the question is there enough countervailing substances to outweigh it or to drown it out? And that then actually ends up being a more interesting conversation about the nature of mixtures, of admixtures, and also of intention, interestingly, too. Because one of the stoppages on that issue is that if you're adding it on purpose, because it's the derech to do so, right? It's the way that you make this thing, or it's the ikar of it. Like the essence of this thing is the fact that you're putting it into it. Then you have a lot of hard time saying like, well, it's just an accidental thing. And like, you know, it can't be avoided. What are you going to do? Or even to say, listen, it's a complex system. And like, there's a lot of like plates spinning. So it's one of the things. But if it's so important that you can't ignore it, again, it's like our empirical experiential side saying, we can't just live in this abstract reality. We need to pay attention to the substance of the matter itself.
I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. I wanted to break in and I've been thinking about all this whiskey that we've been talking about. So here is a sneak peek into next week's episode featuring Molly Lewis from New Riff Distilling.
mash bill between whether it's cast strength or our I have a bottle of it right here, actually, our bottled and bond bourbon. What we call our bottled and bond bourbon, or our flagship that Drew and I are both drinking tonight. This is always 100 proof. Okay. So in order to be called bottled in bond is the highest quality control for a spirit in the history of spirit controls.
I'm looking forward to next week's episode. And now back to our episode.
I don't know that you've spelled it out, but which is that historical piece about the sherry casks and then the not sherry casks, the bourbon casks, the people saying we're missing this, is the intentionality and how much do those casks impart a flavor that is beneficial, Tom Leshevach, and a flavor that is, I want to say derogatory, but it screws it up. No team Tom Leavecom.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, well, I mean, and Letameich, right? According to your perspective, in terms of beer right nowadays, like what's the hip hop beer right now is sours, right? And like sours, you'll find a lot of sours made with, like it says, like featuring like Riesling, right? Or like Chardonnay or something like that. All these wine-based beers. Whereas, you know, like the notion of like mixing wine and beer, that's wild. Who would ever do that? But now, now you know, once beers become fruitier and like more juicy and stuff like that, it ends up being a little bit different.
Well, both the mixtures in the beer themselves, but also being aged in wine barrels.
Yeah.
So those are two separate topics.
Yeah, but that isn't, I mean.
They are, so.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like sours with like actual like wine in them,
Right. Definitely a separate topic, near and dear to my heart. But even, you can even find both sours and also, you can find other beers that are non-sour that are aged in wine barrels. I want to say like you can find some stouts, but probably ales of various sorts you can find aged in wine barrels that without any wine or just grapes tossed into the beers for aging.
Actually, you know, I'm like every other white person during quarantine, I'm baking bread. And I made rye recently, and I like with 100% rye flour, and it was a noble failure. And so a lot of it wasn't fit for eating. So I'm just letting it stale out. And the thing I'm going to make with it is kvass, right? And kvass is liquor made of bread. It's like it's a Russian thing, and usually with pumpernickel bread. But one of the ways that you tell that it's like done fermenting is that you put a raisin in it. And when the raisin floats to the top, it comes up. So that also might be a halachic issue. I don't know where you're going to find commercial kvass, but you know, whatever. What's so interesting to me about this is really that it's delicious, right? And it becomes then a question about our desires. The fact that we want it, is that a sufficient or legitimate motivation for us to be motivated to figure out a way to permit it? Even though if we are like honest with ourselves, we know that there's no way in which we can say that, again, the sherry finishing is going to be depreciating the flavor of the whiskey. We know that. You could say, you know, you can get into it, and I think you can get deeply into it and then find ways in which the question is about how we relate to the thing itself. Like when we're talking about this thing, are there ways in which it's less problematic? So, I mean, one of the ways also to talk about another metalogic question is talking about historical circumstances, right? So originally the concern around Gentile wine is a concern around idolatry, right? That, you know, funny enough, right? You know, we nowadays Jews often flash boil the wine, right? To make a yain mevushel in order to disqualify it from any kind of sacramental purpose. Nowadays, I think most people find, again, stam yeinam, right? Just anonymous generic wine, not to be at risk of being idolatrous, but now the main issue is rabbinic issue, yein nesach, of it being not just a liquid admixture, but a social admixture, that wine is serving the function of facilitating, exogamy, right? Marrying outside of the faith. Now, I think that's a really interesting metaphor, right? Because the way that liquids function is that they seep and they get absorbed into the barrel, absorbed into the cask. I think like the physical metaphor of the problem we're talking is precisely the issue we're talking about, namely the bleeding and the mixing of different communities where we want to keep things discrete or separate, but the way that these things function is to make things mix and connect. Now, that being said, with modern contemporary industrial processes, human contact with these substances is basically eliminated. A very common perspective is that actually there's no physical contact because human contact, because touching the outside of the container doesn't really count. We really mean, like the way you used to make wine in Italy, right? Like stepping on the grapes, you know, treading on the material or mixing it around, or even if you say use a tool, right? Like mixing around, like a wine or a beer that's brewing or something like that. So the issue though then becomes, okay, so it's not idolatry anymore. If it was idolatry, then we would say, no way, we can't even touch this. It's like one of the three big sins, you can't touch it. Once it becomes the fear of intermarriage, and then we're talking about, but it's not even the thing itself anymore. We're not talking about the wine, we're talking about the bleos, which have been absorbed into the cask. So it's like already we're like layers and layers and layers and layers. So the question then actually ends up becoming, is there then a safe contact or a safe incorporation of non-Jewish material that we're not concerned about anymore? Okay. So the actual metzias of it, right, the physical reality of it, might end up then changing the way that we relate to it. We might not see it anymore as like, I'm just getting around it. It might be, no, actually, in some circumstances, we're able to safely incorporate or safely have contact with the outside of the community, even something that was formerly dangerous like wine. I find that a really interesting. So that's actually where Rav Moshe comes in. He has a very interesting point about that when wine is mixed into six parts water, it's not even considered wine anymore. It's considered acid. And because it, you know, or like a, you know, like a balsamic vinegar type thing, right? When the wine is diluted, then it becomes not wine anymore. And because of that, it doesn't have the same kind of attractive quality.
Which he gets from the Shulchan Aruch.
Oh yeah, no, of course, yeah, which it even comes, yeah, exactly. It gets, I mean, yeah, that's the thing, that they're using all of these classical halachic processes or like ways of thinking about these things and trying to think about how do I marry the, I think the whole, the values that the system is trying to teach us and kind of help us live out, namely staying within the faith, which is very important, being conscious and intentional about the ways that we have relationships with non-Jews and things like that. And then the second part of it is the actual physical material, like the metzias itself, the way that those two things interact. And I think that's a beautiful metaphor for Torah in some ways, right? Because Torah is coming from beyond physical reality, from God, which transcends space and time. But then the only way Torah can make itself known and understood to us is by entering human language, communicating itself in human concepts, telling itself in stories and laws. Right? So like everything that we're dealing with in halacha is always something that is itself what we're talking about, and then something where it's gesturing to, something where it's pointing us to. It's what's called indexical, right? It's pointing us towards something. Going, go over there, try to do that thing. I think it really tells us, it's a really beautiful object lesson in how real and serious halacha is, not just as like a thing with, you know, that like you just have to memorize and like learn, but it's something that makes sense and something that's trying to do something and tell us something. The Back to Rabbi Niehaus is a packet. Interesting point you asked about landing more things about the thing. So, I mean, it's an incredibly learned thing. You can find it for free online. It's brilliant, really worth looking into. Recommend it to the listeners. But also, there's one point that, with all due respect, Rabbi Niehaus just want to take issue with, namely, the question is, when the wine is absorbed into the barrel, how much of it do we need to worry about? So there's two standards. One is kedei klipa, like that's only the outer surface of the barrel that we can think is to absorb the wine, or is it the full thickness of the barrel, and that the entire volume of the like the of the material of the barrel itself is what we need to be worried about and consider the whole thing unkosher. And most poskim end up saying it's the whole thickness of the barrel, and because of that, we need to figure out how big's the, like, what's the mass of the barrel. So the way you do that is you do a water.
It's crazy though, right? Because that would mean that it would be just drenched and soaked fully throughout.
But that's the proof though. I mean, there are testimonies that you see the wine actually, like you see the staining on the outside of the barrel. But it's a fair point. You can probably say, yeah, fine, but that's some of them, but not all of them or most of them. That's a fair, it's a fair pushback for sure.
And also like the wood doesn't have any volume unto its own, like, right? The wood probably has to contain some volume of its own.
Right. Yeah, totally. No, totally. But I mean, this is where like the kind of the rules, you know, when the rubber hits the road type of thing, it's the way you kind of deal with it. It's like, you know, like in the Shulchan Aruch, it talks about if a meat pot is bubbling and a meat dish is cooking and a speck of milk hits the outside of the pot, then the whole pot is considered like it's treif. Or, you know, theoretically, and if then you have 60% against that, then it's fine. But yeah, so this one, he's like, okay, fine, but how do we figure out how much the barrel is? Well, you do a water displacement test, of course. You know, we know that ever since the Greek philosophers. But he says, but it's impossible to know how big the barrel is because it's too big. It's what? How much money does the CRC have at its command? You could construct a big vat to figure this out once and for all. It is not impossible to figure it out. And then he kind of like ends up kind of waving it away and basically saying, you're never gonna have enough, six times the liquid in there if you go by Rav Moshe. You're never gonna have enough. You might get close, but you're not gonna get there. You might get there if two things. One is that it's not entirely sherry cask, only partially sherry cask, then you can worry about it. Or if it's not cask strength, but it's mixed afterwards, then you could say the extra water afterwards, you could say would take care of it. Fine. But the truth is that, like, I want to know about the barrel. Like, we can know.
The volume of the whiskey inside is not more than six times the volume of whatever the wood is.
That's the claim.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that seems, that's actually kind of where I lost the packet, because the truth is that, like, I bet it is. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he used like a barrel calculator. So obviously Rabbi Niehaus knows insanely more than I do and ever will. But I think like the way in which it was kind of, I saw it as another kind of like case study or object lesson, the way in which when it kind of, you know, like you pull the throttle and you get out of the empirical model and you go back into like kind of safe conceptual halacha orthodoxy of like, we're only just going to kind of like, live in this detached reality system in which it's only halachic concepts we're talking about. In this case, like, you know, it could be still, we could still be in the empirical world. We could still be in the realist model, but we decide the packet basically just takes it as a given that you can't do it. And it might be true. It might end up being true, but it was just kind of like it was an odd duck.
It's also a strange direction to move in, to go towards the numerical Bittel of the 6-to-1, when like it was never, I mean, in the Talmud and Shulchan Aruch, it's not a numbers game. It's just simply, and not only that, but they, even in the Talmud, they're talking about little jugs, right? They're not talking about massive, huge.
Right, but we're talking about a relative volume, right? Like a little jug is going to have little wine, it's going to have little liquid in it. So like a big cask is going to have more liquid in it. It's just
going to have thick walls. Have thick walls in a little jug.
That's true, for sure. Yeah, but I think, I think the reason we end up kind of being a little bit more detailed about it is because I give Rabbi Niehaus credit for very much, is, I mean, again, katonti, but because it's not just like a yes or no question, it's really the issue of because whiskey is improved by sherry casking, or because the sour becomes more marketable because now it's being aged in the wine cask. We now need to be thinking about, okay, so since the substance is impacting it in a certain kind of way, we need to be thinking about what's the result of that? What's the consequence? What are the implications of that? So we do end up getting into more of a question of, is it a significant enough presence for us to be able to incorporate, or is it so boiling, right? Is it so sticking out and we can't ignore it? It's attractive to us that for us to say it's bottle is lying. And I think that's like kind of the musr aspect, the ethical aspect in halacha, in this halacha question that I'm really fascinated by, is that like, are we going to fool ourselves into satisfying our desire or our ego because we want the whiskey, or are we going to like pay attention enough to our experience to say, I need to take seriously the fact that it's not just conceptual, it's experiential, and I'm experienced to something significant and improved. And because of that, I need to take it seriously.
Yeah.
Like, the sophistication and like the seriousness, like the substantiveness of this as a halachic question. It's not just like a lot of thumb waving and like being chinyukish. It really is about taking our commitment to this halacha, this life path, seriously.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Joshua Schwartz, almost Rabbi Joshua Schwartz, for joining on this lively and enlightening discussion.
Thank you so much already, Rabbi Drew Kaplan.
Absolutely. And with that, I want to wish you L'chaim.
L'chaim.